Welcome to Thinking Out Loud, the podcast that puts you inside conversations with the most deeply passionate, crazy smart, wildly creative, openly collaborative, quietly wise, fabulously funny, intensely dedicated, and yes, the most thoughtful people in our industry. So sit back and stay tuned. They may just change the way you think.
Hello. Today, I'm speaking with Sarah Aubrey, Executive Vice President of TNT Original Programming, a role that has her overseeing all development and production of original series and miniseries. So, Sarah, we could go in so many different directions, but let's just start with a little bit about you and your background. I know that you are a recovering entertainment lawyer.
I am.
So
indeed.
That's a far
that's
cry
a really
from the
funny
space
way
here.
To start.
Well, it's a far cry from where you are now.
Yes.
So put a little bit of context around your background, experience,
sure.
and vision for this role.
Sure, happy to. Well, first of all, thanks so much for having me. And I started out going to law school at the University of Texas and pretty much immediately realized I didn't want to be a lawyer, but I always had loved entertainment and figured the next best thing would be to be an entertainment lawyer and to move out to Los Angeles just to kind of get my foot in the door. And so I moved out and worked at Greenberg Glesker Fields and worked in corporate transactional work, but started moonlighting with a friend of mine who worked with the Coen brothers. And the Coens, Joel and Ethan, said, if you two find a piece of material, we will help you get it made. And so, very long story short, I practiced law for about 3 years. And during that time, I developed a script with the writers Recco and Ficarra, with my partner John Cameron. And we made a movie called Bad Santa with Bob Weinstein and Billy Bob Thornton and Bernie Mac. And it was just quite an experience and kind of my baptism by fire in producing. So I left the firm and went and produced that movie. And that was kind of the beginning of everything for me.
And here you are deep in production.
Yes.
Very focused on originals.
Yes.
And stepping into a role where your boss, Kevin Reilly, had announced that you're going to double your amount of original content in 3 years.
Yeah.
I think that was 3 years ago.
It was.
So
it was.
Have you done that?
We have. We have taken, you know, what I like to say about TNT is that it has been this incredibly successful network. And for a long time, it programmed shows with wonderful characters like Kira Sedgwick in The Closer and all the way through to Rizzoli and Isles. And right now we're finishing up The Last Ship. And it took those characters and put them into more relatable procedural settings. And I think the desire was to keep up the same audience affinity with characters that we love, but take the network into the direction that, frankly, audiences want to go into now, which is serialized shows that have complicated, rich character stories and twisty plots. And. Audiences today want and demand it all from their shows, especially their dramas. And so that's what we've been doing is, as some of the classic TNT shows have come to the end of their runs, we've been refilling the pipeline with new shows like Animal Kingdom and Claws and The Alienist. And we have upcoming I Am the Night that Patty Jenkins is directing with Chris Pine and next summer Snowpiercer. So we've made the shift over to the kinds of shows we set out to make.
So you said the kinds of shows audiences want now, which is different than even just a couple of years ago. The landscape is changing so rapidly. Talk a little bit about what you see as being the new wave in programming right now and what audiences are looking for and what is really resonating.
I think audiences have become very sophisticated about stories. So in my opinion, television, people used to come to television and want to watch 22 episodes of a broadcast show where the characters were like their friends and they more or less knew what was going to happen inside an episode of that show. And it was very comforting to a form of entertainment. You kind of knew what you were getting. And on the movie screen, you got, you know, adult dramas and kind of more layered and sophisticated stories than some of the more traditional procedural type shows that could be repeated for 22 episodes. And I think over time, as the kind of appetite and financial viability of the adult drama started drying up for movie studios, I mean, those are very, you know, typically they are in the no man's land of price point, right? They're not, you know, 20 million or lower. They ooch up into between, you know, 30 and 50, $60 million. And that's a very hard space to make your money back in. And so a lot of that talent started to gravitate towards television. And around that same time, to tell those adult drama stories, and around that same time, obviously, we've had the proliferation of Netflix and Amazon. So there have just been more buyers for that more sophisticated storytelling. And also, 10 episodes versus a 22-episode order is night and day in terms of what you can achieve creatively. It's just very difficult when you have the pressure of 22 episodes of television to make each one such a bespoke little jewel. And I think the 10-episode order has also really enabled us to kind of blast into a new level of creativity.
So audiences are more sophisticated. Mm-hmm. They're also consuming content differently.
Yes. You know,
binging, right?
Yes.
We're binging on the word binging right now. What does that do to storytelling and to the narrative that you're trying to create? And you referenced 10 episodes.
Right.
Are we really looking at almost elongated movie formats?
No, actually, it's interesting. I feel very strongly about that. TV is its own beast, and it exists in this, you know, 50, 55-minute form. And I don't know about you, but I don't want usually more than an hour. I mean, it's funny. Sometimes when you can look on Netflix when something starts to get a little bit longer, or even HBO, where I don't have that same flexibility. But you start to feel it. Like, most of the time, you want the story to wrap up. So every now and then, it's nice to have, like, an extra dollop of Game of Thrones. But I think there's something really satisfying in a tightly structured 50 minutes. And I think that what has started to happen is, as I was saying, audiences understand all the moves of basic storytelling. And so they're open to being surprised. You can now do an episode. Like, for example, when I was a producer, I produced the TV show The Leftovers with Damon Lindelof and Tom Parada and my producing partner, Pete Berg. And the third episode of the very first season of that show, we had our main characters, but we introduced our main characters in the first 2 minutes of the episode, and then a character that literally had been drifting around in the background, I mean, like, walking around in the background, had one line. We followed him out a door, and the entire episode was about him. And that kind of storytelling would just have been unheard of 3-4 years ago. I mean, you know, the network, everyone would have been like, what the hell are you doing? Like, where are our main characters? We've barely established them. And so, but that kind of stuff is fun, and audiences are surprised and then delighted by being surprised.
Is this why we're also seeing a boon of limited series?
Mm-hmm.
It's a nice, complete package to present to the viewer.
Yes, and it's interesting. You know, one of the challenges for limited series from a business model perspective is you have to launch it the same way you would any TV show. And we all know in this day and age, to get attention in this environment, you really have to have a great campaign, and you have to be in the right places and talking to the right audience to get someone to even say, I might watch this one day. It's so hard even to get appointment viewing, et cetera. And so you have to spend the same amount of money to launch a limited series, but obviously that money does not get amortized over, you know, 50 episodes. It can be amortized over 6. So it's a pricey proposition to put out in the world. But by the same token, the advantages of the limited are, one, you can tell stories that are not meant to stretch beyond 6 hours. I mean, some things, like, again, going back to the show that I'm working on with Patty Jenkins and Sam Sheridan and Chris Pine, based on a true story about this young woman, Fauna Hodel, in the 60s in Los Angeles. And it always was too much as a movie, but it's not a TV series. And so it's absolutely perfect as a limited. And also, frankly, Chris Pine doesn't want to sign on to do 5 years of a television show, but to do 6 great hours with a character that he loves and that he's not playing on the big screen right now has, I think, by all accounts, according to him, been a really good experience. And so that's really where The Limited has a sweet spot. Stories that don't want to be longer than, you know, 6 to 10 hours, and also getting talent that doesn't have to make a multi-year commitment.
So what happens when a limited series is such a hit that you decide to go to season two?
Well, there are all kinds of ways that that can happen or cannot. I mean, first of all, you have to get the talent back. And so that's a trick in and of itself, because normally you make different deals when you're making a limited series. So you don't necessarily have a deal in place to continue. So you've got to kind of go back and put all of that together again. And that can just be a barrier to entry, period, to reassemble everyone. And then I think the bar is high. If you've succeeded as a limited, there's a certain kind of, I don't want to say, you've got to go back to the audience and say, I know we promised you that this was done, and we told a satisfying story. And so I think you've really got to look each other in the eye and say, okay, this is a worthy second chapter. We're not just doing it because we had success. We're doing it because there's more story to be told.
We have a number of those happening in the industry right now, as you know. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with the season twos that are coming up of some very successful limited series that launched.
Yes.
Let's talk about The Alienist.
Right.
I don't think it was introduced as a limited series, but it was based on a book.
Yes.
And you did cover the story that was in the book.
Exactly.
And you're now going into season two.
Well, we haven't decided yet whether or not we're doing season two.
Oh, okay.
So that's still...
Oh, darn. And here I was already.
I know. It's funny. I mean, I'm glad you bring it up. I was going to kind of do it as a PS to the previous question. You know, it's exactly that situation, which is we have a wonderful cast. You know, I think they're very engaged and interested in continuing. And there's potentially Caleb Carr has written more books about these characters. But we also, I think, feel like we did intend to tell The Alienist in 10 episodes without leaving anything from the book out. And we wanted to finish it. And I think that's part of the appeal of it. So everyone's talking to each other, and we're still, you know, I think, very much considering it, but we haven't decided yet.
Well, as a viewer and a fan, please keep talking.
Thank you. We are. I'm pushing. You can be assured.
Okay. Well, I'm pushing too.
Thank you.
So we just touched on another theme, big hot topic and theme at the Television Critics Tour this year of books to TV. And The Alienist is a good example of that. Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit about the opportunities and pressures of taking a book and bringing it to television.
Sure. Well, The Alienist is kind of a perfect example because it was a saga to get it made. I mean, Caleb Carr set the book up at Paramount almost 20 years ago, and there were so many attempts to make it into a feature film. And it kept running into the problem I talked about, which is at the end of the day, it's an adult drama. But because part of the joy of the story is this setting of turn of the century New York, it truly is. I mean, this phrase gets overused, but the place is a character in this. And so I think it just kept foundering, you know, on the, we shouldn't even bother to do this if we cannot give the financial resources to create this world. And, you know, I wasn't there for all of that. That was in their feature division. But I know there were just a lot of, you know, attempts, valiant attempts. But there was also the issue of it's kind of too long to fit into 2 hours. I mean, it's not, you know, a lot would be condensed and you would have kind of the speed of another body, another, you know, and I think that sometimes is tricky. It feels a little convenient or fast. And so balancing that in an adaptation can be hard. And so it seems that the 10-hour version of it was the sweet spot because it allowed us to have the time to get to know these characters more so that you weren't just having to stay on the story of the case and you could take diversions and understand their history and their histories with each other. And we did get to build that New York fantasia. I mean, the set of it was just extraordinary in Budapest. And our wonderful production designer, Mara Lapierre-Schloop, who created this, you know, block after block of turn of the century New York City and Budapest, just did this amazing job. And we built that, and it was very expensive, but it was for 10 hours, not just for two. So it made sense, again, to make that investment.
You're probably listening to this podcast because you're a smart, busy executive who wants to keep up with the latest news and trends efficiently. And you're probably also a CTAM Smart Brief subscriber. Did you say no? Then you're missing out on the finest industry news briefing, deftly delivered daily to your inbox. Like I said, it's smart, it's brief, it's always free, and read by thousands of leaders like you. Sign up today at smartbrief.com/CTAM.
You also mentioned earlier complicated character studies. Mm-hmm. That's another theme that seems to be rampant right now in the industry. A lot of the new shows mm-hmm. have more complex, deeper character studies, drawing out character storylines. We're not getting to know characters in just the first episode anymore.
Right.
Why is that? What's going on with viewers right now that we seem to be looking for the deeper relationships with characters?
Well, I think one thing that's changed, and you look back to somebody like Tony Soprano, at the time, that was such a cutting-edge character because he would have been the villain of any other television show, and in that show, he is the hero or the anti-hero. And so I think what started changing a long time ago now is that we were willing to see flaws in our favorite or our main characters. And I think that by kind of opening the door to that representation, you then could just show and go places with people that you had never been before. Someone didn't always have to be the strong one, the right one, the good one. They could be the confused one, the sad one, the one that screws up. And I think just opening that door has allowed for all of this storytelling. And it's a personal, I consider it in my job, a privilege to be able to commission and work with writers and directors and actors creating more complicated female characters, which is something that, you know, women especially always were, you know, kind of cast in more simplistic terms. And that's been such a, you know, delightful turn of events.
I'm going to go back to The Alienist just for a minute because I know it reached a cumulative 13 million plus total mm-hmm. viewers in the telecast that aired in its initial week, which is impressive.
Yeah.
And congratulations.
Thank you.
But nearly half of those were new to the network.
Yes.
Yay.
So,
right. That's a
success.
How do you keep them? They've seen The Alienist.
I'll tell it.
Are they now TNT viewers, and are they interested in what else you have to offer? Or was that a one-hit wonder because that program just caught their eye?
No. In fact, we've spent a lot of time being strategic about, now that we have them, what do we do with them? And we anticipated, we like to plan for success. And we are launching a whole collection of shows called the Suspense Collection. And the next show that will go on in the Alienist time slot in January called I Am the Night, and it stars Chris Pine and India Isley. And it's essentially a retelling of a true story about a young woman who comes to Los Angeles in the 60s to uncover who she really is. She finds out that her mother is not her birth mother. And so it's a story that starts in this incredibly relatable, fundamental question of, who am I? Where do I come from? And it opens the door into this incredible noir underbelly of Los Angeles at the time, and it touches on issues of race and class and art and murder. And so it's just really juicy in the same way that The Alienist was. And then following that, next summer, we have another mystery called Tell Me Your Secrets. And this one is so near and dear to me. It's written by a British writer, and I read it as a sample probably 3 years ago now, and we waited and waited until it fell out of the BBC, and I snatched it, and I have been dying to get it on screen. And it's essentially asked the question of, what happens when you find out that you have fallen in love with the wrong man? Relatable, right? I think we've all had a bad relationship or two. But it turns out that he is actually a serial killer. And it picks up this woman's story after she has gone to prison for being an accessory. You don't know to what extent she knew or participated, and she's putting her life back together in witness protection while coming to terms with her past. And in the meantime, the mother of one of the victims who is still missing is trying to hunt this woman down to find out if her daughter's alive. And so Amy Brenneman plays the woman who is searching for her daughter, and Lily Rabe plays the former lover of the serial killer who's in witness protection. And they're on this collision course with so many twists, but also, again, two very complicated women. And in this show in particular, you're never sure who's the good guy and who's the bad guy. And it, in fact, changes often over the course of the series. So I think, and we have more in the pipeline. So I think the intention is we've brought this audience for The Alienist, and they're going to come back for these mysteries that have these twists and layered characters, but also are limited. And so I think it's appealing to know this story will finish and it will have a satisfying conclusion, and we're not holding back anything. Go like hell to the finish line and make it extra juicy.
You talk about women characters, and one of the things that you've been focused on and the work that you've been developing is diversity, both in front of the camera and behind the camera. Women's voices, women's empowerment, strong characters. Talk a little bit about your vision there and the impact of what you've been doing there.
Well, I think that when I started the job, I saw both a business opportunity that Kevin and I identified together, and I felt, frankly, a personal obligation, and frankly, it's my privilege to be in a position where I can open the door for more women and people of color to tell their stories. I mean, it frankly is one of the best parts of my job. So first, the business part, I think that if you look at the audiences for a lot of the premium cable outlets, not all of them, but many of them skew male in terms of their audience. And so we really see an opportunity for TNT, and it has with its new shows, to skew female but not disinvite men. So I think, you know, there's some networks that are more traditionally almost 100% female viewers. You know, we like to consider, you know, it's a show that a woman will watch, and if she's with her husband, he won't make her turn the channel. Like, all of our shows have, you know, a visceral quality to their storytelling that I think is appealing, you know, to everyone. And so, one, that's a business opportunity. And two, I just think that to break through, you have to look for new voices, because if you tell the same old stories from the same old points of view, you're not going to get an audience in this crowded landscape. And so I actively am looking for all kinds of new points of view, whether it be from a woman, from a person of color, from someone that, you know, doesn't live in this country. You know, I look for diversity of all kinds of voice. For example, with our show Claws, you know, it's created by Elliot Lawrence and Janine Sherman Barois, and they just bring an absolutely raucous, wild, nuts kind of voice and tone to an incredibly relatable, emotional story about friendship and sisterhood. So you have this great mashup where that show can take wild detours into kind of sex and crime, but at the heart of it, there are these women that have each other's backs and are trying to still swing for the fences in terms of having a dream and living that dream. And I'm particularly proud of that show because it does have such a diverse cast, and someone complimented it the other day and said, but no one talks about it. No one says, isn't it so great that we have a Latina woman who's gay, friends with, you know, a Black woman, friends with, you know, an Asian woman. Like, it's never commented upon. It just is. These women are friends. That's how we meet them in the pilot, and they love each other. And they're also, many of them, 40 or older and are hot and having sex. So I like that part of it too. So we're really just like trying to bust open a lot of boxes.
I know you were instrumental in the Shatterbox anthology film series. partnering with Refinery 29. Mm-hmm. I know that that's giving the next gen female storytellers an opportunity to create short films through the female lens. But what else do we need to know about that?
Well, Refinery had started the program, and it's just awesome. I mean, to focus on that and give women an opportunity to pick up the camera and tell their story. I think that people have been hearing about this a lot over the last couple of years, and the drumbeat has gotten especially loud in the last 9 months. But the reality is, you can't just turn on a faucet and, you know, outpour the female directors. You have to build a pipeline. And I found very quickly in my job, one of the obstacles to writers, but even more so directors and in some cases crew, is that we don't have the pipeline in place. So when we're in the mad frenzy to staff a show or to hire a director, we very quickly like, okay, well, who are the female directors who are available? Oh, none of them are available. I guess we can't have anybody. And that was a really unsatisfying answer. And so a large part of what I try and do now is dig deeper.
Who else?
Who else? Where can we talk to people? Where can we find people? So when Refinery came forward and said, would you all like to partner in the second, you know, kind of season of Shatterbox, I jumped on it, and with my one request being that we focus on women that are one kind of piece of their resume away from being episodic television directors, being qualified or being considered to do that. So I was, not that I don't think this is equally valuable, but my focus was less on giving true first-timers an opportunity, because I really want to get that next crop up and in. And so I think that, for example, as I mentioned, Janine Sherman-Barwa, who's our showrunner, I said to her, well, you should be directing. And she was kind of a little resistant at first, and then she said, heck yeah, and was in and made an incredible short for us called French Fries. And it had such visual style, and it allowed her to, as a writer, then be in control of how her story looks and feels. And we are in active development on that now as a show, and also giving her name to our sister network as a potential director for their half-hour comedies, because she really proved her chops in that. And that, to me, is the success of the program.
And do you feel that the environment now is more willing to embrace this transition of new women talent stepping in? Or has it always been there and it's just more top of mind?
No, it has not always been there. And yes, I do think, and frankly, part of it is because there are more women in positions to hire women. It is that simple. And there are, of course, men that hire women, of course, and there are a lot of men that get it and are, you know, down with it. But I think that it comes down to having, you know, women in those chairs.
Were there any women in your career who pulled you up a step, helped you, mentored you, created opportunities for you?
You know, there are definitely women along the way who have been helpful to me. It, for a long time, was the great sadness of my career that there were not that many. And frankly, if I'm being candid, there are men that have been incredibly helpful to me. But it's part of what makes me so committed to mentoring and reaching down, because candidly, I wish I had had more of that.
Well, I share that with you, and it's sad.
But it's sad, and it's hard, and it's hard to admit. And you don't, and I don't know about how you feel about it, but it is like a warm wind has blown through the room with these young women that want other women with them, that link arms with them, that aren't trying to bang their way into a boys' club, but say, let's all be here together. I mean, I'm sure, like, often I was the only woman in a room.
Yeah.
And if there was another woman in the room, half the time, she was not thrilled that I was there. And I think that, you know, or if we were, we almost both felt like we better not act like we're both women or we're going to get kicked out of here. You know, I mean, this is all unspoken, very subtle. And again, I want to say,
but I'm sitting here nodding.
Yeah, I know,
of course,
you are.
You know,
I know.
This is what we experience.
Yeah.
So you're now trying to change that, and you're working very hard to change it, not only behind the camera, but in front of the camera. And I find that really interesting, because there aren't that many women in positions who can do both.
Yeah.
And so talk a little bit about the in front of the camera part and how you approach creative development to give women different opportunities to portray women differently, which of course opens the door to opportunities in different ways, because we all grow up watching female role models,
right,
and that influences what we think is possible in our lives,
right. And I have two girls and a son, and frankly, I'm happy for my son to see all these women as well. I mean, to be clear, he was like the one weeping on the floor when Hillary lost. So I think we've already done our work with him, but I'm not kidding. It was a long morning.
My son was in tears too, so Jesus. Right there.
But the first thing that we picked up was the show Animal Kingdom in my job. And what I loved about what John Wells and Jonathan Lithgow had brought to me in that show was this woman who was literally about to eat her young. She was the most flawed mother I have almost ever seen on camera. I'm trying to think. I mean, I guess Tony's mom in The Sopranos was pretty horrible, and I think Ellen Barkin plays the indomitable Smurf on Animal Kingdom. But she is, within 2 seconds, lovingly petting them and making them meatloaf, to then inappropriately kissing them on the lips, to then threatening their lives. And I was like, well, this is a great character. And, you know, I think that it's the secret sauce of the show is we have, you know, a really incredible cast across the board on that show. But I think it was these boys with this woman as their effective crime boss and their mother that I was just, you know, saying, yes, yes, yes.
You can answer this last question any way you want. What's next?
Well, for us as a network, what's next is we have worked very hard to establish this, you know, kind of beachhead. We have right now the three in the top 10 cable dramas. We have three of them. And that's a landmark for us. I mean, I'm very proud of it. It's been a lot of hard work. And, you know, you have to have nerves and you got to go through the roller coaster of it. But to end up here this summer with Animal Kingdom and Claws and Alien is great. And so to me, how do we build upon this? And how do we continue to push into new areas? And so, for example, we have a big partnership with Ridley Scott to bring some big sci-fi shows to our network. And you're like, oh, sci-fi, are women going to watch that? Because of course, you know, you traditionally think it's a male genre, but in fact, that's not true. And so to me, it's crafting shows, and Ridley especially with, I mean, you think about Sigourney Weaver and she defines the badass woman. I mean, as growing up, I had never seen anything like it. I mean, she just lit the room on fire. And so working with him to craft new stories, and we have two great scripts, both with really interesting female characters in them, but also huge, you know, sci-fi world. And so for me, you know, continuing in the vein we're in, but also opening the aperture to some new genres.
Well, the industry's working really hard to push into what's next and leverage new opportunities. So thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and your experience with us today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. What a fun conversation.
Hope you found this Thinking Out Loud conversation interesting and perhaps even thought-provoking. There are more on the way. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and leave a review.